Hello, and welcome to the Lies.com podcast for Friday, April 28th, 2006. I'm just going to do a quick one today, monitoring my battery level on my PowerBook. It looks like it may have to be a quick one, or I may lose it. And I don't have a lot to say, which is kind of a scary thought, given how much I can ramble about nothing under normal circumstances. Something I'm doing on Lies.com that may take a little while to actually bear fruit, and I'm speaking of Lies.com, the weblog now. I noticed the other day that it had actually been 10 years since the first item I ever posted on Lies.com, and that anniversary came back in February, early February, and I realized that, I let this anniversary pass without noticing it somehow. So I've put together a posting for the site that I've titled a Lies.com 10th Anniversary Reader. And in it, I've gone back through the whole history of the site, and I've selected earlier posts that I want to make a few comments on. And as I went through it, I said, I've got to include that one, and I've got to include that one. Well, by the time I was done, I had about 100 different items, and that's pretty much ridiculous. So working on weeding that down now and getting to where I have it, a short enough list that I can go through and annotate some of them. And I hope it'll be interesting. It's an interesting exercise for me. I'm not sure how interesting it'll be for the site's readers, but I assume that the majority of the people coming to the site are not familiar with the site's history, so it'd be nice to have something like that that kind of points out some of the highlights of the past. I wanted to follow up just a little bit about the subject of my last but one podcast, where I ranted for pretty much the whole time about David Allen Sibley and the ivory-billed woodpecker. I got into a little email correspondence with one of the ivory-billed skeptics who was asking questions, and he was very polite about it, asking questions about some of the stuff I'd posted, and in answering his questions, I kind of clarified some of the things. I mean, I gave more specifics, and it struck me that I could really give more specifics here, too, in my podcast, that what I did before was really basically an appeal to authority. I said that Sibley's wrong, and Fitzpatrick and the rest are right, because I say so, and then I just talked a little bit about why I thought that was plausible, that why I thought it was that Sibley was doing what he was doing. And that is pretty much in keeping with my approach to podcasting and posting on Lies.com generally, that I really view them as conversations with myself, with someone. I tend not to get into a lot of explaining and a lot of didactic, well, I believe this because of this and this and this and this. Sometimes I think I can end up losing whatever potential audience I have because I'm assuming too much. I'm assuming that the reader shares my obsessions, for one thing. And I'm assuming that the listener knows what I'm talking about already. And I don't need to provide examples. I mean, I'm shying away on this site, in this podcast, from really debating my intellectual opponents. I'm not really interested in debate. I think I've been soured on the whole notion by things like the right-wing echo chamber's approach to that they've really moved on and are not interested in considering other positions. They're just interested in scoring points. And I don't want to just score points. I don't want to engage in that kind of tit-for-tat. But I'm also not necessarily interested in engaging in some kind of asymmetric contest with someone of a different opinion. You know, if you disagree with me, fine, disagree with me. I'm using this as a venue to speak my opinions. I take what I consider reasonable care to avoid letting my own biases impel me in a certain direction. I'm well aware that from someone steeped in a different ideology, that what I do looks like ideologically steeped opinionizing without a lot of data to back it up. But again, I'm not necessarily interested in going that distance to meet someone like that halfway. You can't take something halfway between, in my view, you can't take something halfway between my position and, say, a fan of Rush Limbaugh's position and assume that that's actually truth. Because the people on the Rush Limbaugh side of the debate have recognized that by pursuing extreme positions, they can increase their audience, they can make themselves feel good, they can satisfy whatever sort of emotional need it is that drives them to that position in the first place. You know, to me, there really are at least three poles on this spectrum, which is getting to be a horribly mixed metaphor. But on either side, left or right, or whatever other axis you want to define, people who believe in something thoroughly, people who have lost any or never had any sense of self-doubt, they've really destroyed any chance they had of knowing the truth, at least in subtle, non-obvious cases. And I think a lot of the truth that's out there is subtle and non-obvious. It's this, you know, it's like catching a delicate insect. It's like catching a butterfly. You have to have this gossamer net. You know, you can't go in there and clutch at it. You'll destroy the thing you're after. If you go into something like this with a, you know, an emotional slant, it's very easy to miss the truth. Anyway, I was going to talk about Sibley a little bit before I got sidetracked in talking about why or what I'm going to say about Sibley. And in this case, I do want to provide a little more detail than I normally do, is the whole point of that digression. I was describing the thing that I'm now going to not do, or at least not do quite so much. If you look carefully at the arguments that Fitzpatrick et al. And Sibley et al. Make in their debate over whether or not the Leno video really does represent an ivory-billed woodpecker, and the larger question of whether or not the evidence does support a claim that at least one ivory-billed woodpecker did exist in the woods of eastern Arkansas in the summer of 2003 or whenever, you know, you go back the dates of the sightings, it becomes clear that what the proponents of the sighting are doing is actually real science. And I'll give examples of that. What Fitzpatrick's team's doing is they're saying, okay, well, here's the evidence we've been able to gather. And they list it. And it's eyewitness accounts of people who've said they've seen an ivory-billed woodpecker. There are a number of accounts. At least one of them involved two people simultaneously making the identification. All of them are relatively brief, you know, these sightings. It was a fleeting glimpse. But the best of these sightings, from a credibility standpoint, were all by people who are arguably experts, or at least a large number of them were by people who are arguably experts. Some of them actually literally world-leading experts in large woodpeckers. In short, these are not people who are going to casually mistake a pileated woodpecker for an ivory bill. So you have that evidence. You have the sound recordings. And I'm not really going to get into that so much, except to say that, you know, those, well, I'll get to the criticism in a second. So you've got the sound recordings, which not only to the ear, but to sound spectrum analysis, give a strong indication that they are, in fact, ivory-billed woodpecker recordings. And then you have the Luno video. And the Luno video is not great evidence in and of itself, but evaluated in the context of that other evidence, evaluated objectively, it yields some interesting information. And I think my understanding of what's going on with the analysis of the Luno video is based in part on my own experience as an amateur astronomer and a follower of real astronomy and, you know, magazines like Sky and Telescope, which is a consumer magazine but has a relatively strong scientific orientation in terms of its news coverage and just a fairly high degree of scientific rigor in terms of how it presents the subject matter. And astronomy is an interesting case because with astronomy you have this exact situation that's playing out now with the ivory-billed woodpecker rediscovery and the analysis of the Luno video. You have limited data. You have serious limitations on what data are available because of how far we are from the things we're studying in astronomy. So you get little images. You get, you know, things that are a few pixels across. You get ambiguous data with lots of noise in it. And you have to do a lot of really careful analysis. And astronomers have become very good over the decades at doing good science, which means looking at the data you have and thinking very carefully about what the limitations of that data are, and thinking very carefully about how you can augment that data, how you can interpret that data, what are other forms of data you can gather that will be useful and will allow you to make interesting inferences. And it's not immediately obvious a lot of the time. You know, it requires heavy use of that odd organ that we humans have evolved to a high degree. So if you look at what the Fitzpatrick team did in their analysis of the Luno video, they didn't just say, well, does it look like an ivory-billed woodpecker or a pileated woodpecker? Because just looking at it, it's clearly ambiguous. You can't really tell. But they started asking questions like, okay, of the extent of white and black that you see on the wings, since this, of course, is the key issue for determining which of those two species that video shows, you know, the configuration of white and black on the top and bottom of the wings are the primary difference between the two types of woodpecker. They said, okay, in terms of what you can see there, let's go out and measure what the limitations of this video technology are in terms of white tending to bleed into a larger area on the video image, in terms of the movement of the image tending to blur what you see. So they made two wooden models, one of an ivory-billed woodpecker, one of a pileated woodpecker. And using that same camera, under those same lighting conditions, in that same location, they moved the models along the path that the actual bird followed, and they videotaped it with that camera. And they, you know, it was an articulating model, so the wings would move up and down, so they were able to get the motion. Now, true, it was not a very sophisticated model, and this is one of the criticisms made by Sibley in his paper. But it did allow them to draw some conclusions about what that video would and would not show. And the conclusions they drew were that basically using the ivory-billed model, they were able to produce a video that looked a good deal like what the actual Leno video showed. Using the ivory-billed model, they were able to do that. Using the pileated woodpecker model, they were not able to achieve that. In the pileated model, the black trailing edge of the wing that you see on a pileated woodpecker was always visible in the video, in a way that it's really not visible in the Leno video. So that was one thing that they did. Another thing that they did was this issue of wing beat analysis. And if you look at you can measure very clearly, one thing you can do in the video is you can measure the speed of the wing beats of the bird as it flies away from the camera. And they took that and they compared it to a large number of videos of pileated woodpeckers flying away from a camera, which they have, they have a lot of that. They don't have video of ivory billeds flying away, but they have a lot of video of pileated taking off and flying. And they were able to measure the wing beat speed of a typical pileated woodpecker and the range within which the wing beat speeds of a pileated woodpecker tend to fall. And what they found was that a pileated woodpecker taking off and flying away has a certain characteristic range of wing beat speeds, and the bird in the Leno video's wing beats were significantly faster than that. So this got them kind of excited, and they set out to say, well, if we could just find an example of an ivory-billed woodpecker's wing beat speeds upon takeoff, we could see, is it faster or slower, or the same as a pileated woodpecker's? And there is no existing footage, film footage it would have to be, since we're going back to the days before video for this kind of work. But there is no existing film footage they were able to find of an ivory-billed taking off and flying. But they, in fact, had an audio recording at which you hear an ivory-billed woodpecker that was being recorded at close range by this microphone, and then you hear the sound of a big, noisy bird flying away from the microphone. And they interpreted this to mean that what they had there was an ivory-billed woodpecker flying away from the microphone. And they were able to analyze the speed of its wing beats. And lo and behold, the speed of its wing beats was a very close match to the speed of the wing beats seen in the Leno video. And, were significantly faster than a pileated woodpecker's takeoff wing beats. Now, to me, this is pretty cool evidence. This is going beyond what the data immediately shows and finding some supporting information that allows you to make an inference. And yeah, it's a lot. There's some uncertainty there. Could have been another kind of bird that somehow, that flew down and landed by the microphone and then took off. And that information was never recorded in the notes accompanying the sound recording. Hard to know, but it's very suggestive. And it's another piece of the picture. And at a certain point, as you gather pieces of this picture, as you gather different viewpoints on this question from multiple sources, and as you do the actual work, as you do the actual science of going in there and asking what the data show and coming up with ways to test your hypotheses, that's where you're doing real science. That's where you have a chance of actually advancing your understanding beyond just the guesswork that characterizes a non-scientific approach. Now compare this with what Sibley et al. Do in their criticism. They talk about the models that the Sibley team created, and they criticize them because the wings are not really articulating the way a real wing would. They don't twist the way a real wing would. And they postulate, they hypothesize that, well, it's the twisting of the wings that would produce the images seen in the Leno video, even if that were in fact a pileated woodpecker being photographed. So they offer this as a hypothesis, but they don't actually test it. It's not like they went out there and they made their own models, their own enhanced models that actually do twist in the way that a real bird's wings do, which, come to think of it, is not impossible to do. You've got footage of pileated woodpeckers in flight, you know, you can make a model and you can add an articulation around the axis of the wing bone, and you can make it so those wings actually twist. You know, you make a little puppet and you can actually manipulate it until you get something that approximates the way a woodpecker flies, and then you could go repeat the Cornell team's experiment with their video camera in the woods under the same lighting and the same distance, except you now have the articulating wings. But they don't actually do that. Sibley et al. Didn't actually do, as far as I can tell, any actual work other than to look at the evidence that had been presented by the Fitzpatrick team and pick holes in it. So they offer this hypothesis. Oh, okay, well, the reason your model showed that could be because your wings and your model don't twist. Well, fine. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. You have to test it. That's what science is. In the case of the wing speed analysis, they make this response. Sibley basically writes, well, one would think, generally, that the larger a bird is, the slower its wing beats would be. Therefore, it would be odd if the ivory-billed woodpecker's wing beat speed upon takeoff was higher than that of the pileated woodpecker, because the ivory-billed is somewhat larger than a pileated woodpecker. And they point out, and Sibley points out, that, you know, we don't have documentation or we don't have proof that the audio recording of those wing beats are in fact the wing beats of an ivory-billed woodpecker. And with that, he dismisses that aspect of the Cornell team's case. And again, it's the same thing. He didn't actually do the science. He offers a hypothesis. The hypothesis, you know, he actually offers two hypotheses. One, that larger birds will always have slower wing beats upon takeoff than smaller birds, or within the same group of birds, within a closely related family, you would tend to find that the larger birds would have slower wing beat speeds upon takeoff than the smaller birds, and that audio recording actually does not record an ivory-billed woodpecker takeoff. And the first of those, and those are, again, basically these are hypotheses. You know, he doesn't offer evidence in support of that. He simply offers it as something that seems reasonable to him. And again, at least in the first case, you know, there's an obvious, it's an obviously testable hypothesis. You could go out and you could gather data on wing beat speeds upon takeoff in other woodpeckers, preferably, or in other families of birds, and you could measure. You know, you could come up with a much better understanding of how closely size does correlate with wing beat speed upon takeoff. Is it a hard and fast rule that the larger a bird, the slower its wing beat speed on takeoff? Or are there exceptions to that rule? And if there are exceptions, how common are they? You know, what kinds of birds tend to show them? Can you come up with any kind of explanation of what's really going on there in terms of the relationship between size and wing beat speed? But again, the Sibley team doesn't do this. They simply throw out their hypothesis and let it stand on its own. And again, this is fundamentally anti-scientific. This is the first step in the scientific process, but it is nowhere near a sufficient step to disconfirm something. It's the starting point, it's not the ending point. So that's a little more detail on what's going on in my mind with Sibley's response. Sibley basically is not a scientist. He's an artist. He's a bird identification expert. He's an obsessive bird watcher. He's very much part of that camp that it's called in England twitchers. You know, these are people that are into birding as a competitive pursuit. They're into pursuing rarities. They're into getting good bird identifications. And again, I don't know Sibley personally, and I don't know how fair it is to lump him with those people, but I see, again, it's a hypothesis on my part. It's not a proven scientific fact, but I see a suspicious coincidence, if it's not linked causally, between his expertise at birding and his acknowledged obsessive approach towards bird identification and this behavior that he manifests in his criticisms of the Fitzpatrick paper on the ivory-billed woodpecker rediscovery. He's not a scientist. He's not doing science. He is a competitive birder. And, you know, really it's about a distinction. I mean, if you've been involved at all in competitive birding, you understand how they approach these issues of claims of sightings of rarities. It's much more like a courtroom approach than a scientific approach. And yeah, courtrooms sometimes have scientists in them, but there is this... There is this fundamental difference in how human beings approach the search for truth. There's these two fundamentally different methodologies that human beings have come up with. And one is the courtroom methodology. You know, and this is the one that says, okay, we've got limited data. Nobody was there at the scene of the crime other than the accused criminal. But we need to try and figure out what the truth is. We need to come to some kind of judgment of guilt or innocence. So we set up these rules for how we do it. And we put together the best evidence we can. We get everybody together in a room. And we give them their chance to go out and raise their information. And then we put all the data together and we make our decision. You know, we make our judgment. Bummer, I've got a road closure because of an accident. Hope everyone's okay. Looks like we had a pretty nasty one there. So where was I? So we have the courtroom model of how you find out the truth. And that's really what birders do. That's what birders do in terms of finding the answers. And then you have the scientific approach, where the emphasis isn't so much on coming up with the best judgment you can within some arbitrarily constrained set of circumstances. It is coming up with the right answer, and coming up with a way of knowing when you've found the right answer, coming up with a way, a reproducible, reliable way to find the truth in cases where the evidence is ambiguous. And it's a very different process. And Sibley and his team are not doing it. You know, if you stand back above the fray and set aside the question of whether you want the ivory-billed woodpecker to exist or not, which of course is a big component in the emotions of anybody engaged in this debate, and just say, well, let's just look at what they're actually doing. Let's look at, you know, let's assess their methodologies. Let's assess their experimental design. Let's assess their logic they're employing. The Fitzpatrick team wins that comparison from a scientific point of view. In my book, it's not even close. Because again, what the Sibley team is doing is not actually science. They're not actually making a serious scientific challenge. They're not grappling with the data in a scientific way. They're simply asking this question. Well, can I come up with a hypothesis that would tend to disconfirm the conclusions of the Fitzpatrick team? And they can. You know, clearly you can. You can come up with a hypothesis that you can come up with, that you can explain away the Fitzpatrick team's arguments. If that's your goal, you can come up with plausible hypotheses, especially as long as you don't actually test them. You know, you can come up with any number of explanations of why they came to the wrong conclusion about the existence of the ivory-billed woodpecker. But until you're willing to actually test those hypotheses, that's all they are. And in my view, that's all that the Sibley team has offered in this case. Well, I guess that's it for now. I want to thank you for listening once again to this Lies.com podcast. This podcast is copyrighted and distributed under a Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I'm John Callender, and thank you very much for listening.